So I figured since it was New Year's, and this might be a little bit of a longer sermon because it's New Year's, right? So we have some more energy and more time to sit and listen. I'm not sure how long it is, but we're going to see. But since it's New Year's, everyone's always really in the mood for what? A challenge, right? For New Year's, right? We're thinking about New Year's resolutions and things that we want to do more of, things that we want to do less of, right? I've already had a list in my mind, constantly looking at my life and things that I think need to change. I, you know, probably do more videos like that, more wigs, more outfits. No, I'm just kidding. Probably do more things that, you know, benefit the walk that I have with Christ, primarily. More things that are geared towards His kingdom. I've been thinking about things that I need to do less of and challenge myself in areas that I probably need to grow in, and all those, we should always be doing that, reflecting on where we're at in our Christian walk, reflecting on our lives and things that we, you know, not getting down in the dumps or despairing over those things, but taking a healthy look and just saying, okay, yeah, Lord, I need to kind of work on these areas in my life. So I figured we can do a little challenge to start out the new year, you know. And it's funny, often the times when we're going through tough times and I'm going through a tough time, I'll ask the Lord for encouragement. And when I read the Bible, He always challenges me a little bit further. And I'm like, oh, okay, Lord, I kind of see what You're doing there. So we're going to do a little New Year's challenge today. We're going to be looking at Luke 9:57 through 62. And we're going to be talking about what it means to follow Jesus Christ. We say that, you hear that a lot, but what does it really mean to follow Jesus Christ? And actually, today we're going to be looking at what it means not to follow Jesus Christ, because we are going to be looking at some following fails. So Luke 9, if you have your Bibles with you, Luke chapter 9, verses 57 through 62. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Navy SEALs and the fact how hard Navy SEAL training is. The school that the Navy SEALs go through, or before they are SEALs, the recruits go through, is called BUD School. It's Basic Underwater Demolition School. And the last week of BUD School is a very, very difficult week, and that week is particularly designed to separate those who are going to be committed to the SEAL program, no matter what the cost, and those that just aren't ready for it, that just can't do it and would rather go back to the life of a civilian or a less demanding job in the Navy. One guy talks about the training that occurs during Hell Week. He says there's a lot of constants. The trainees are constantly in motion. They are constantly cold. They are constantly hungry, and they are constantly wet. Mud is everywhere. It covers uniforms. It covers their hands. It covers their faces. Sand is everywhere. It burns their eyes. It chafes their raw skin. Medical personnel are everywhere. They stand by for emergencies, and they monitor the exhausted trainees. Something that is not constant during this time is sleep. They say sleep is fleeting. There's a mere 3 to 4 hours granted at the conclusion of Hell Week. During this time, the trainees consume up to 7,000 calories a day, and they still lose weight. One individual says that the belief that BUD's training, and Hell Week in particular, is about physical strength is an actual misconception. It is 90% mental, 10% physical. Students or recruits decide that, forget this, I'm too cold, I am too wet, I am too tired, and they quit and go back to their lives. One individual says that you actually have to act like a caveman and realize that there are no creature comforts anymore. You learn to enjoy food like it is a wonderful gift. Moments of sleep feel like it's hours. But regardless of all of this, how weak stands, the finishing Hell Week still stands as the defining moment for a member of a SEAL team. You have earned the right to start the training to become a SEAL after this gut check, as it shows the SEALs that you want to be there and you will not quit no matter what the cost. During the training, there's a BUDS instructor and he has a bullhorn. And as the guys are holding these heavy logs or whether they're freezing in the ocean, he's yelling stuff through this bullhorn. And he's saying to them, if you quit now, you can go to one of those luxurious rooms at the hotel down there on the beach and do nothing but sleep and eat all that you want. Throughout the hell week, the BUDS instructor continually reminds the candidates that they can drop on request at any time. They can go and simply ring that shiny brass bell where it stands for all to see. Folks, following Jesus Christ, discipleship is a constant hell week. It is not easy. Jesus does not promise us that when we decide to follow him, everything is going to be honky-dory, everything is going to be comfortable, everything is going to be easy, you can forget all the problems that you have. Following Jesus is a life of self-denial, it is a life of hardship, and it is a life of sacrifice. Following Jesus is not comfortable at all. I wanted to be a Navy SEAL at one point, but thankfully God had other plans, thankfully for myself and for our country, because I'm not really sure how that would have worked out if I ever made that training. And I actually trained when I was young to be a Navy SEAL. I was, in my own mind, not really their training, because I would have died. But I would go into a swimming pool with a friend, and I would hold my breath underwater. We'd be swimming constant laps. We'd be doing cold water entries at night, all trying to be a Navy SEAL. And then because I admired them. And what I admired most about them was their commitment. They were committed to a cause despite what that commitment brought upon them. I didn't, of course, become a Navy SEAL, but I did join the military, and it taught me a lot about commitment and the reality of such commitment. Just the normal boot camp and the additional training that I received afterwards was not as easy as I thought or I was told it was going to be. My commitment was tested, just like those recruits during Hell Week. The life of a disciple has its tests, has its trials, and has its temptations. Temptations to return back to a life of comfort, temptations to return to the sin that we have left behind, temptations to say, you know what, forget this, I'm done with it, I'm going to try this another day, and temptations to go back to the life that we once had. The nice thing about Jesus, he provides the bell ahead of time. He lets the recruits know exactly what they are in for, and they can ring that bell before they even start. John Piper talks about contemporary evangelicalism, and he says this: the great tragedy of much of contemporary Christianity is that the cross is safely regulated to the distant past. And practically, what it means is that Jesus was soaked in blood so that I can soak in a jacuzzi. I want to set the stage of this passage that we are looking at. And it's very important to see where Jesus is literally walking and what it means to literally follow him to these three would-be disciples. Jesus is headed in a certain direction. Do you know where that direction is? He's headed to Calvary. Jesus is walking literally to the hill of Golgotha to die on a cross. Following Jesus means following him to that hill. This is the second time that Jesus talks about the demands of discipleship. The first time is when he says, If you want to come after me, take up your cross and live a life of self-denial. Following Jesus is following him to that hill on Calvary. It is a life of self-sacrifice. It is a life of hardship. But it is worth every bit of it. But he wants us all to realize that following him is a constant hell week. I see three fails, or three what it means not to follow Jesus in this passage before us today, and hopefully we'll be able to get through this without any scrapes and bruises, but we're going to dive right into it. So the three questions for us, three disciples, I've named them so we can identify with them, what it means not to follow Jesus and the three fails that we see. So the first one is, are you an Isaac, the idealist? And if your name seems to match these people's names, it's not a reference at all. Unless you think it is, but I'm not sure. But yeah, so are you an Isaac the idealist? Verses 57 through 58. As they were going along the road, someone said to him, I want to follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said, hey, that's great. We got coffee mugs. We got t-shirts. We got pamphlets. Come along. You're in for the ride of your life. Oh, no, wait a second. Wrong translation. Jesus said to him, the foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has absolutely nowhere to lay his head. I'm sure many of you have looked at some extreme sports and have been interested in them. Maybe you were watching the ESPNX games during your Christmas vacation, and you're looking at those guys who are, I don't know, base jumping, skydiving, whatever it is, and you're like, hey, I want to do that. That looks like a lot of fun. Constant thrill. Look at all the crowds. Everything seems real exciting. Guy talks about that the assumption that extreme activities like these provides constant excitement. And he says that that assumption is wrong. Extreme activities like traveling through space, we would think that that would be a wonderful, exciting extreme activity, or climbing Mount Everest. Not exactly, he says. A book written by two researchers, Extreme, Why Some People Thrive at the Limits, shows that many thrill-seeking activities involve a lot of ordinary, uncomfortable, tedious moments. For instance, he says, here's how NASA astronaut Gene Cernan summed up his overall experience of space travel. He said this, funny thing happened to me on the way to the moon. Absolutely nothing. I was bored out of my mind. Space travelers aren't the only ones killing time and battling boredom. During their free climb of the Dawn Wall in Yosemite National Park in California, Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen spend a large part of many days waiting, just waiting for the shade to hit and to climb that wall. As a matter of fact, there was a study done on how many people spend actually climbing, and it's only 4% of their time, specifically when they were climbing the Himalaya Mountains. The book concluded that although a yearning for novelty and excitement may draw people into certain activities, they inevitably require long periods of patience, discipline, and perseverance. How many times have we gotten excited about a new hobby or a new resolution? How many times have we idealized those goals or those commitments? And then when we actually get involved in them, we're like, ah, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. And then we're disillusioned and we walk away from it. I've done it, right, numerous times. I've given up on stuff and I'm like, ah, this just really isn't what I thought it was going to be. Well, folks in Christianity sometimes are like that. They get caught up in the moment of this new adventure, and they respond with their emotions. They look at Christianity through rose-colored lenses. They want to be part of the action. They want to be part of the community. They want to be part of the novelty and the excitement. And they make this decision to follow Jesus, and then reality hits. And they are disillusioned with it. So this man, it's kind of interesting. We want to set the context of what's going on here. This man, I believe, is a scribe, as do many commentators do. And I think that he has been following Jesus all along, kind of maybe watching from a distance. We have to realize all of the excitement that is going around with Jesus. He had just healed people. He had cast out a demon from somebody, and he fed 5,000. So this guy is seeing all these wonderful things that Jesus is doing. He's like, this is great. And if he's a scribe, maybe he's thinking, hey, you know what? Jesus is going to do a lot for my position in life. Jesus is really going to raise the bar of my life. He's going to give me a lot of stuff. Look, this guy is healing people. I got constant, you know, perfect health insurance with Jesus, right? I got healing from demons. I'm protected from evil, and I'm fed all the time. This is going to be absolutely awesome. So he looks at Jesus and he says, hey, Jesus, I want to go with you. I want to go where the action is. I see all these crowds. I see all these people. I see all your popularity. This is absolutely wonderful. And Jesus tells him the truth of what it is like. He says, look, the creatures that I have created, foxes and birds, they have a place to go. They can come and go as they please. They can go and look for food. They can go out and play. They can go out and explore. And they can go back to a place of comfort, of safety, and acceptance. Not me. And not those who follow me. I see 2 points here in this illustration that Jesus gives. The first one is that the life of a disciple is not always going to be physically comfortable. The life of a disciple requires us to forget all of those comforts and really go where Jesus wants us to go. And that may not be into a very, very comfortable place. It means that we have to be willing to give up our creaturely comforts. The life of a disciple is not always going to meet our physical needs. It is going to be hard. And if you and I begin to squirm when our physical comforts are taken away, when we are following Jesus, we need to question whether or not we have understood what it means to follow him. Because life is easy when we're what? Comfortable, right? I'm like that. I'm a baby at home. I got my blankets at night. I got my bed. I got my socks. I can follow Jesus like this all day long. This is great, but what happens when those comforts go away? We need to understand that nice warm bed, our comfortable clothes, the church that we meet in may not always be here. What are we going to do then? Are we still going to say to Jesus, hey, Jesus, I'm going to follow you wherever you go? Or are we going to go back to the malls and go shopping, go back to our beds, go back to our warm houses? I wonder sometimes as I look at what we've been through, is Jesus testing us in this area? Was he testing us when we had to go meet in the parking lot? Is he testing us when we got to put on masks? Is he testing our comfort level? Is he saying, hey, what are you going to do? What are you going to do for me? What are you going to do for other people? We're going to go through it? We're going to say, you know what? It's not what I signed up for. I want to see a connection here, which brings to the second point that I see in this. Why are we comfortable? Why am I comfortable right here in this climate-controlled, nice-seated, beautifully decorated sanctuary? Why do we have this comfort? You know why? Because we're accepted in society. You and I are accepted. Most of our comforts, the comforts of home, the comforts that we have of our church, the comforts that we have of our jobs, the comforts that we have in our lives, is because we are accepted. Christianity is allowed. There's going to come a time, and is quickly coming down that road, it's not going to be allowed anymore. Jesus was rejected 3 times leading up to this encounter. He's not comfortable because no one wants him. And there are people, there are Christians in this world right now that are not comfortable because they too are rejected. They're not allowed to meet. They're not allowed to be Christians. They're not allowed to go home to their parents and sleep in their beds because they've chosen to follow Jesus Christ wherever he goes. Jesus was just rejected in Samaria. They didn't want him staying there. He tried to find lodging. They're like, no, get out of there. He was rejected when he healed the demon-possessed man in the Gerasenes. And he put the demons into pigs, right? And the pigs go running off the cliff. And they're like, hey, you're not good for our economy, Jesus. Get out. He was rejected in his own home, Nazareth, where they took him to the top of a cliff and they wanted to push him off. So maybe if we're into adrenaline sports like base jumping or cliff diving, then follow Jesus, because you might just get a free ride. The second person that we do not want to be like is delaying Dan. Verses 59 through 60. Another, and he said, so this is Jesus talking, and he said to another, follow me. But Dan had other plans. Dan said, Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father. And Jesus said, oh, sure, that's fine. I'll just wait right here for you. Jesus, that's another translation again. Jesus said to him, allow the dead to bury their own dead, but as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God. We all know excuses, and many times excuses, I know excuses in my life reflect where my priorities were at that time, right? So if we make an excuse for something, usually it's because we thought that whatever we were doing, and now that we weren't able to do, we had to make an excuse for it because this was more important than this. And that's kind of what Dan is doing right here. And there are many excuses, but there's a few unique ones that bosses have heard over the years. One of them was, I was here, but I fell asleep in the parking lot. So sleep was more important than the job. Oh, another one was, I like this one a lot, my fake eyelashes were stuck together. So beauty was more important than work at that time. And if your eyelashes are stuck together, you cannot drive. So that's probably a good thing. Another one was that an astrologer warned me of a car accident, so I took the scenic route. Another one was that I had morning sickness. Legitimate excuse, but it was from a man. Excuses and delays. Just like the workers of the world have them, so do would-be workers and current workers of God's kingdom. Here we have delaying Dan. Dan, hey, Jesus, I can't make it to work today. I have this really important thing to do. I have to bury my father. And commentators are divided on whether or not Dan's dad was dead at this time or was about to die. But Dan says an important word. First. Let me first. And I want us to see here that Jesus, this isn't an option for Dan. This is a command. Jesus says, follow me in the present tense. Do it when? Right now. There's a sense of urgency in Jesus with regards to what? The work of the kingdom. Jesus is not saying that we are not to take care of our families. What he is saying, I'm first, and my work is before any priority that you may think is more important or that you have. I want us to compare this follow me and Dan's response, and we never hear of Dan, right? Dan's not a disciple. We don't hear of the great disciple Dan, who traveled all over the world proclaiming the kingdom of God. Why? Dan goes back, obviously, to bury his father. Listen to what Jesus says when he gives the same command to Matthew. After he went out, he noticed a tax collector named Levi sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, follow me. What's Matthew's response? He left everything and got up and began to follow him. Not, he didn't say, hey, Jesus, I got to finish up these books right now. Let me give out this money right now. This is my job. This is my livelihood. He says, nope, I'm going to leave that aside. Why? No longer a priority. You're my priority. I'm going to go and follow you. He says it, same thing. He says to Simon and Peter and Andrew. Now, as Jesus is walking by the Sea of Galilee, he says he saw two brothers. Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, follow me, and I'm going to make you fishers of men. And immediately, they left their nets and they followed him. Again, notice the response. They don't say, hey, Jesus, we're just going to haul in this net of fish right now. Just give us a second. We'll be right with you. No, Jesus changes the priorities of their work. And he says, you are doing the world's work right now. I'm going to give you a new work to do. Does it mean that they can't go fishing anymore? Absolutely not. That is not what he is saying. But what he is saying is that this work is more important. And when you have time, you can go back to that work. I still fish. Jesus didn't tell me to give up fishing. But what is my priority in life? His work, his kingdom. He uses this word kingdom a few times because he's letting us know something. Hey, you belong to a different world. The priorities, the responsibilities, the affections that we have are all second place to him. What it means to follow Jesus, that which is of first importance. We have to understand the magnitude of what he is saying to this man here. Because this was no ordinary excuse. This was about as legitimate as it gets in this culture. Burial for one's parents to the Jews was of utmost importance, a top priority. In Israel, giving an honorable burial to the dead was considered a duty and a kindness that ranked higher than any other service requiring attention. Cut and dry. We lose our own priorities. We have to be willing to say, all right, Jesus, I'm going to take a new set of priorities. Doesn't mean, and one of those priorities for some folks may be their family. Jesus may be saying, hey, you have kingdom work to do in your own home. Stop spending so much time at your job. He might be saying that. But what we need to do is say, look, if I'm going to follow Jesus, all of those things get pushed aside and I let him set up those priorities in my life. And I'll tell you what, that's why a lot of folks won't follow him. They don't want to give up control of the wheel, do they? They want their own priorities. They want to put themselves first, their work first, what they believe is important first. And if you are not a follower of Jesus and you're thinking about it today, if you're watching from home and you're like, hey, I'm going to check this Christianity thing out. This sounds like a pretty good deal, but you know what? I want to do some stuff in my life first. There's other things I feel like I need to take care of. Don't delay. Do not wait. George Sweeting wrote this story in Special Sermons for Special Days. He says, several years ago, our family visited Niagara Falls. It was the spring, and ice was rushing down the river. As I viewed the large blocks of ice flowing towards the falls, he said, I can see that in the ice, embedded in the ice, were carcasses of dead fish. He said, seagulls by the score would land on these little ice pads and they would feed on the carcasses as the ice is floating down the river. As they came to the brink of the falls, they would fly off and then start their journey all over again. He said, I watched as one gull seemed to wait and delayed. I wondered if it would ever leave. He said, it was so engrossed with the carcass that it didn't realize it was coming to the brink of the falls. And then when it finally did, it outflew its wings and it flapped and flapped and flapped and flapped. It even lifted the chunk of ice out of the water for a period of time, but it was too heavy. It sank below and died because its claws were frozen to the ice. Do not wait, because you don't know if that funeral is going to be yours. Do it today. Third fail that I see here, are you a divided Doris? And I know that it's a man that he talks to, but I didn't want the women to be like, oh, he's only talking to guys. There's no women in here. It's Dan, it's Isaac, and it could have been David, but it's not. It's Doris. We're just going to pretend here, do a little artistic license, I guess. Now, here's Doris. So another also said, I will follow you, but first permit me to say goodbye to those at home. And Jesus says, oh, can I go with you for the party? I'd love to join you in this long-term goodbye. No, Jesus does not say that. Jesus says to him or her, no one, after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. To illustrate Christ's call to discipleship. Pastor Tommy Henson shares what he likes to do with his son on some evenings. He and Riley enjoy watching YouTube videos of space shuttle launches together. I've seen one actually. Has anyone seen a live space shuttle launch? Cape Canaveral. When I was down in the military, we waited up and it was absolutely incredible, especially when it's dark outside and stuff. So it's really, really, really cool. So these guys, they watch the space shuttle launches together. He said, as you're watching the video towards the end, there's a point where you hear a phrase. The phrase is negative return. Negative return. According to NASA's official website, negative return occurs when the space shuttle is flying too far downrange and too high to return to the launch site in the event of an engine failure. It also means that for the astronaut, they are now to the point where they are assured of making it into orbit, which is the entire point of the shuttle launch. Henson comments and says this, Jesus is saying only by crossing the point of negative return, letting go of that option to turn back, can you actually follow me and do what you are meant to do? Whatever your landing site was, your identity, your past life, your family, your purpose, before you came to me, you need to leave all possibility of returning behind. The whole point of following Jesus is following Jesus, is saying goodbye, world, goodbye, family, goodbye, friends. I'm following someone else. This person does not do that. This individual, this looking back, is in the present tense. So there they are. They want to grab the plow. They're saying, I'm going to follow you, Jesus, but wait, let me do this. What does that mean? The position of our eyes reveals the affections of our hearts. That's where their heart is. Heart is back in their previous life. They want to go back. They want to go back to the life they had, and they just want to say goodbye just for a little bit, just a little goodbye party, Jesus. Maybe we can't make a straight line for the kingdom because our heads are turned back, too busy looking at this world, longing for what we used to have, and the work of the kingdom shows it crooked lines. Some people drop that plow and say, I'll pick it back up in a little bit, go back to the world for a little visit, never to return again. Why? That's where their hearts are. That's where they are. We cannot be a disciple of Christ having one foot in the kingdom of God and another in that of man. If you are going to follow him and you are constantly looking back at the life that you have left behind, that is where your heart is. And Jesus says, don't bother. I don't want you. Unfit for the kingdom. Why? Because their heart is in the world's kingdom. They don't want to be with Jesus. They don't want to go where he's going. They don't want to do what he's doing. They want to go back to the life that they supposedly left behind. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve God and this world. This is a divided heart, and really a divided heart is a decided heart. It's a heart that hasn't decided to follow Jesus. It's a heart that still loves this world. There are many examples in the Bible of divided hearts. The majority of Israel never left Egypt. Though they were rescued from Egypt, they continued to long for Egypt, and it showed every time they faced a hardship. Why did you take us from Egypt? We were so happy in Egypt, even though we were being beaten and we were slaves. Can't we go back to Egypt? Why did you bring us out here to die? Can't we just have a little bit of meat? And we all know what happened to them. We just read about it in 1 Corinthians. Their bodies were in the desert because their hearts remained in Egypt. The other one is Lot's wife. She was out of Sodom and Gomorrah, but her heart wasn't. She looked back, longing, wondering, man, I'm going to miss that place. That place was awesome. And because of that, she was destroyed along with it. Because that is exactly where her heart was. Jesus wants it all. And it doesn't mean, and this is one of the hardest passages in Scripture I know. It doesn't mean that we're not going to be tempted. It doesn't mean that our eyes aren't going to glance once in a while to that. But what he's telling us is, look, if you're going to follow me, then follow me. If you're going to be longing for that world, for that sinful lifestyle that I've freed you from, stay right there. Unfit for the kingdom. C.S. Lewis says this, look, if you live for the next world, if you live for heaven, guess what? You get both in the deal, right? I tell you what, I have never enjoyed life more. And since I've been a disciple of Jesus Christ, I have enjoyed friendships more. I've enjoyed family more. I've enjoyed food more. I've enjoyed this world more because of him. Because it's enjoyed in its proper boundaries. And I'm going to enjoy that world even more, right? But if we live for this world, we lose both. Make a decision to follow Christ. No turning back. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. What happens? This is going to grow dim. It's nothing. You want this world? It's going to end up like Sodom and Gomorrah, folks. It's going to be nothing. And that is not what he has called us to. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. When I joined the Navy, I had a recruiter. Yeah, I saw pictures and advertisements. And of course, everyone is like clean and really good looking in those pictures. And everything's honky-dory and everyone's so happy. And you go to the recruiter. And what's the recruiter's job? Does anyone know? Get recruits. Okay, yeah. So because the recruiter's job is to get recruits, honesty is not really a top priority, is it not, right? Yeah. Zane knows, shaking his head, right? You're told things. You're like, woo, this is going to be great. Oh, yeah, you're going to love it, brother. And they're like, they're telling stories later on. I got this guy, and I told him this, woof. And I tell you what, he's going to be in for a rude awakening. This guy tells a story about his recruiter not being exactly honest, and he learned that The recruiter learned that this guy liked to read. He said, so he told me that there was a library on base, right? So the guy's like, oh, whoa, great. Hey, library. Can read all I want. But what he didn't tell him is that no recruit could go there until they earned the privilege, and that you couldn't earn the privilege until at least the sixth week in boot camp. And that when you did earn the privilege, you could only go there for an hour. He said there was another guy. He became the laughing stock of the base when he showed up for boot camp with his fishing pole and water skis. This was not me. Because the recruiter told him that the base was on an island, which was very, very true, and that you could fish and water ski there, which was true. A person might be able to do that, but not if that person is a recruit. Jesus, he says, is an honest recruiter. He would have no man enlist under false pretenses. He wants us to understand something. There's a battle to be fought, a race to be won, work to be done, many hard things to endure. Salvation he is ready to bestow without money, without cost, without price. Grace is ours and glory in the end. All this shall be given to every sinner who comes to him, yes, but he would not have us be ignorant that it is a battle, that we shall have enemies, the world, the flesh, and the devil, and that many will hate us, many will slander us and persecute us if we become his disciples. He doesn't want to discourage us. He wants us to know the truth of what it means to follow him. Folks, I am afraid that American evangelicalism is full of dishonest recruiters. We have dumbed down discipleship. No commitment, just comfort. No sin, just safety. No trouble, just a treat. We've made following Jesus fun, and we've created fans instead of followers. It wasn't fun for those who were lined up at Nero's palace and set on fire to be used for torches to light his pathway. It wasn't fun for those Christians who were tossed into the gladiatorial arena to be devoured by lions. It's not fun for those right now who confess Jesus as Lord and are ostracized from their society, disowned by their very family. It's not exciting or comfortable for those who are at risk being taken to prison just for meeting with other Christians who do not meet in a comfortable sanctuary, but in underground churches, wondering if those that were there last week will be here this week, or maybe they have been snatched up, never to be seen from again. We have a question to ask ourselves after this. Are we willing to follow Jesus? Are we willing to follow Jesus if it means losing our closest friends? Are we willing to follow Jesus if it means losing our reputation? Are we willing to follow Jesus if it means losing our rights, losing our comforts, losing our homes? Are we willing to follow Jesus if it means losing our lives? Are we willing to follow Jesus, not on our terms, not on American evangelicalism's terms, not on this world's terms, but on his terms? You see, Jesus does promise us comfort, peace, security, and a world free from suffering. But all of that comes after Hell Week is over. Father, this sermon has been a challenge for me, Lord, as it should be, and I pray that it has challenged all of those who are listening today.